If you find yourselves on the battlefield, remember that I will make even the dying echo of your heartbeat a sword. I will make the stilled sound on your tongue a roar. I will recall you when you are a ghost in the water, and by that recollection you will be divine. On your death, I will make the very blood in your body arrows and spears. Remember that I am the King Undying. He lifted his hand off the communicator button, cutting short the primal, triumphant howl that had echoed from the docking crew. You were painfully aware of the lamplights of Thalagy signifying the cohort officers in the dock, 10 of them in a cluster a mere 40 meters away. Too close to be doing anything to aid the shuttle, but praying, maybe. There were more of them farther away, an orderly line, flushed with blood, pattering with gut flora. They were perhaps working the mechanisms. There were muffled booming sounds as the shuttle clamps were loosed. The engines behind the blood-daubed wall groaned to life in a huge, dull roar. Those Thalagy lights fell farther and farther away as you were lowered out the airlock on long struts of plex and steel. Mercy eased a lever upward, nose wrinkling in concentration, and then the Thalagy rose away entirely. You dropped through space. The shuttle might as well have been empty for all that you could sense within, except for that single, fetal bundle of Thalagy lying still inside the coffin. As you looked through the plex window behind you, you saw the Erebos, and for the first time you got a sense of the enormity of the flagship, its scintillating, dark and rainbow-hued steel, like an oil spill. The interlocking skeletons tessellated over the whole boxy structure so that the vessel seemed an enormous moving ossuary. The iris of light from the fuel ignition hurt your eyes as it sped away. Artificial gravity meant you were perfectly still and stable, but you still felt ill from the idea that you were drifting and tumbling through space like an abandoned piece of cargo. God said, "Children, attend." You hardly needed the invitation. The Emperor was drumming his fingers on the back of the pilot's seat, his curious black-on-black eyes not focused on you. He said, "You are both going to have to listen to me very carefully. The Mithraeum is far away, and our route is not typical. I'm about to teach you the first lesson, and this lesson will be the foundation of the most important lesson you will ever learn as a lictor. There will be a time for you to learn through questioning, a time for you to learn through trying and failing, but right now you'll learn by doing exactly what I ask of you. The only other option is your destruction." This did not give you much pause. You were a daughter of the locked tomb. The option of destruction had been your constant companion since you were 3 years old. Ianthe, whose voice was low with barely suppressed excitement, said, "I thought there might be a Steely."
"A Steely is 8 feet tall, covered in the dead languages by special fifth adepts, and continually bathed in oxygenated blood," said Mercy Morn from the pilot's seat. "The type of thing where, if there is one on board, you say quite soon, 'Oh, look, a Steely.'"
"Thank you, elder sister. I so love to be educated," said Ianthe. "Where we are going, there are no obelisks for a Steely to hook onto," said the Emperor, whose fingers had ceased drumming on the back of the pilot's seat, after his lictor had told her god, repressively,
"That's quite annoying, thank you,"
and were now restlessly adjusting one shabby shirt sleeve. "I am taking you both through the river." There must have been no small measure of blank incomprehension on your faces, he said, a little abstracted now. "It's the only way. Faster than light travel turned out to be a snare, the way it was originally cracked, anyway. The first method destroyed something to do with time and distance, rendering it unusable for any good purpose."
I've always thought it should be correctly managed with wormholes, said the Saint of Joy, doing something obtuse with the controls, or spatial dilation.
God said, It's in that wheelhouse. We came up with the Stele instead, and the obelisk, which are less to do with travel than they are to do with transmission. But there will be times in your future when you will have to move unfettered by needing an obelisk, and even times yet to come when you will fulfill the sacred literal duty of setting obelisks, and that means travel through the river. I like to think of it as descending into a well.
There was a small noise of upset from the pilot's seat.
Teacher, said Mercy, it is the river. There is a perfectly good water metaphor waiting for you.
Well, I want the idea of two depths, and I don't want to confuse them with the idea of speed, where none...
It's the river, which perfectly well lets you say, imagine the river.
Mercy, either you don't like my previous perfectly good river phrasing, or you do. Pick one.
I will not help you to make hippopotamus travel happen, thank you for the option, my lord, said Mercy.
In that case, despite hippopotamus being a perfectly good word that both catches the ear and does what it says on the tin, let's deviate, said the Lord of the Nine Houses, who apparently existed within a complex power dynamic. I'll use Cassiopeia's.
Oh no, the lava, said Mercy.
Girls, imagine a rocky planet with a magma core beneath the mantle. Travelling overland from point to point might take a year. If you understood your journey and the relative spaces well enough, you could instead drop into the magma, which would carry you to your destination in an hour.
He paused. The inside of the shuttle seemed very silent to you. There was no sound from its internal apparatus, excepting an occasional huge creak from its rudder mechanism. Ianthe's voice broke this mechanical, cold-steel silence by saying, quite carefully for Ianthe,
Teacher, the river is an enormous liminal space formed from spirit magic, populated with ghosts gone mad from hunger.
The magma metaphor falls apart from here, said Mercy, eyes still on the pilot's switches.
The Emperor responded with perfect gravitas.
Let us imagine the magma is full of unkillable man-eating magma fish. Two problems arise. The first is that beings made of flesh and blood immediately die in magma. The second is our vulnerability to man-eating fish.
Your tolerance for man-eating magma fish would have been tested sorely by anyone who was not God. His divinity earned God, you thought, about 60 more seconds. But then he said more quietly,
We are about to travel 40 billion light-years to where we first ran, myself and my remaining six. One of our number was dead already, and another had been removed from play. We needed somewhere to lick our wounds, somewhere far away from anything we loved, to wait, to disperse, without fear that the eyes turning upon us would plough straight through the nine houses as they went. It's a dark and cold and unlovely part of space, and the stars there are old and were nearly dead then. We nuked them with Thanagy, and now they'll shine forever. But the light is not the same. It would take us years to get there if we went from Stele to Stele. How far away from the system was number 7 at last reckoning, Mercy?
Counting down, 5 years, said Mercy Morn, whose hands had at last stilled on the board of buttons and switches and enamelled bone. 5 years, 6 months, 1 week, 2 days.
The merest blink of an eye, said the Emperor beneath his breath.
He pushed himself away from the pilot's chair and said,
We worked out a while ago, I say we, but I had little to nothing to do with it, that distance is different down there. The river doesn't flow through the time and space we're experiencing right now. The river is, well, it's a current below us,
as in the magma analogy. Distance in the river doesn't map to distance above. If I drop us into it, we can emerge almost immediately across the universe, home. The station. Our refuge. We call it the Mithraeum.
He spread his hands wide. Ordinary hands, ordinary fingers, ink-smudged nails.
Look at the ward. What is it?
You were beginning to note the register of his teacher voice. This was familiar ground, untouched by magma. The ward undulated in the shadows a little, which was a trick of the light and the blood. You said,
"It's just a ghost ward,"
and after a second regretted speaking like a provincial bone witch. Thankfully, Ianthe was even more petulant, and a dyed-in-the-wool flesh magician, as she added, "It's not even a sophisticated ghost ward. I mean, it's exquisite, impeccable, right down to the coagulation. But I was doing those when I was 5.
"That ghost repellent will keep our ship from shaking apart," said the Emperor. "That ghost repellent will have every lonesome spirit for kilometres screaming away. For a time."
1:33, said Mercy.
He said,
"Give or take."
The Emperor came to drop on his haunches in front of you and Ianthe, as he had squatted before Mercy Morn earlier. It still hurt you in an undefinable way to see him lowered so, as though he offered a compliance test where you ought to flatten yourself in front of him as low as you could go. The white ring around his pupil was so white.
"Your job is simple, in the way most very tough things are. I will push us into the river, and I'll push the ship with us. You'll have to keep your minds. I can take your physical bodies, but your souls won't go with them, not without you holding them steady."
"Physical transference past the liminal boundaries," you said, and were surprised by the knowledge coming out of you, as though it weren't your own.
"This is deep fifth spirit magic."
"And I bless the fifth house, and I bless their long memory," said the Emperor. "They only go far enough to tempt lost ghosts to them. They stand on the sidelines and wave around bits of meat and anchoring material, but they don't even approach the shore."
Ianthe sounded much more like her twin sister when she said, wonderingly,
"But if applied universally, this would revolutionize the fleet. We could expend no fuel or effort, traveling instantly. We would be truly unstoppable."
Mercy laughed a nasty trill of laughter.
"A powerful necromancer at the peak of their game could last 10 seconds in the river," said God, pushing himself up to stand. "Soul magic is the great leveller. In the first few seconds, their thanagy would all be stripped away, then their thalagy, and then their soul. They wouldn't have time for the ghosts to get to them. They cannot, returning to our analogy, live in magma."
"We can live in magma," said Mercy Morn,
then pressed one elbow into the pilot's deck and pressed her head into that elbow and complained,
"No, I'm doing it."
"A lictor has a metaphorical sitting temperature of over 1,000 degrees, said the Emperor.
He had gone to check the boxes again, and the clasps. Space rotated slowly past the windows, inordinately black and dizzying.
"We have this incomparably done ward, exquisitely created by an expert who gave her heart's blood for it. It may last for around 1.5 minutes. I'm hoping for upward of 1:40, with work like that, and we're on our own from there. No lictor has lasted longer than 7 minutes in full physical submersion, and that was a titanic effort on the part of Cassiopeia the First, who was brilliant and sensible and careful. She thought she could bait physical portions of the resurrection beast into the current. She was right. It followed her."
You said,
"And?"
Mercy said lowly. It turned out that being sensible and brilliant and careful doesn't keep you from getting ripped to shreds by 10,000 feral ghosts.
Ianthe said,
But the beast...
Emerged unscathed 20 minutes later, the Emperor said, and... Life's a bitch.
He looked out the window to the stars and to the jewelled gleam of a planetoid in the distance, which looked a sooty red from your position.
Unbuckle your belts, he said.
You both did so.
Lie down on the floor.
You and Ianthe said as one, your voice a parched whisper, hers low and cool.
Yes, teacher.
Self-conscious of your limbs, you lay down on the floor. The kindly prince said very evenly,
Start slowing your breath. I want it at 2 per minute. If you need to flush yourself with oxygen, do it now. It has been a long time since I have thought about teaching this trick, and I barely know where to begin.
You should start with Pyrrha's trial, called out the other lictor immediately.
Right, said the Emperor. Then, I mean, I was being more or less facetious, Mercy, but yes, I'll probably begin there. Do you both recall the projection trial back at Kanan House? It would have been in Lab 3.
You recalled the enormous construction of regrowing bone, your hands encased in it so that you could not wrench yourself free, your mind voyaging nauseously into the chamber of another person's brain. God said,
You'll need that skill set now. Your mind and body won't couple automatically in the river. You have to hold them together, and any wrong move will see your consciousness stuck on the outskirts of Dominicus, wondering how the hell to get home. Most of the time, you won't even bother taking your body into the waters. It's too dangerous. But for physical travel, we'll need mind and body both.
Your mind was racing, and you cursed yourself, not for the first time, for not continuing your advanced studies into spirit magic. You said,
What happens to a literal body without a soul?
God hesitated.
Being separated from your soul won't kill you, he said. Not immediately, but...
But we'll kill you, said his saint. Immediately. A lictor's body, empty, with its battery intact, but nobody in the driver's seat. Do you know what could take up residence? Anything could get inside you. Any horrible or evil or lonely thing. Any miserable revenant or worse. And you, you ninth house child, are not remotely qualified to fight an outside predator. You are like a little baby. Listen to this. If we get to the other side and find you've gone and left your soul behind, I will separate your brain from your skull without waiting for you to catch up.
And God said nothing. When do we start? Ianthe's voice was clinical, like she was waiting for a tooth extraction.
Start, said Mercy Morn. He began submerging 30 seconds ago.
God said, Timer?
Set at 5 minutes.
We need a slower pace. Set it to 6.
5:30, said Mercy Morn,
but God said, I am not negotiating. Call out the increments once we hit waterline. The Saint of Joy said with unexpected obedience,
Done. Be careful, teacher.
In the depths of space, now the depths of the river, the shuttle was a false gravity cocoon. You did not know which way was up or down or in what direction you were going. You were lying on the floor, trying to stop your lungs from expanding too quickly. Slowing your breath was blurring you out. You did not feel at peace, but rather numb and transfixed, heavy-eyed, until God said,
Keep conscious.
And you stretched out the muscles of your calves until they strained down to the tendons above the balls of your feet. You lay on your mummified sword, which skulked sullenly beneath its cork of bone. You stared at the ceiling. You tilted your head and found Ianthe looking through you. She was lying bracketed between her own rapier and her own offhand, and you were close enough for discomfort. Mercy said,
"Hoods over your heads. They're translucent for a reason."
And the Emperor added, "It's easier when you can perceive light, but not get distracted." You're not sorry to do this. Your vision softened into a jumble of lights, like looking into a headache or white noise. There were no shapes or shadows. The Anthae faded into a mother-of-pearl lump beside you. It was impossible to tell which visual sparks of colour were due to the cloak and which were your own shimmers of migraine fright. Your breath sounded an unlovely peal. The Anthae's sounded like a bellows. You could not hear that of the Emperor of the Nine Houses. Maybe you never had, nor that of the Elder Lictor. The shuttle's habitation controls had either been turned off or set low even by Ninth House standards. Beneath the thin robes and minty smock, your thighs were pimpled with cold. And nothing happened. No thanagetic flush, no thalagetic wane. You'd never been a spirit adept, and you did not feel now any subtleties of transition. It was very cold. That was all. You were dead weight in that heavy chill, each breath a ponderous inflation of the lungs in and out, in and out. You were aware of yourself, of each juncture of energy inside you. You were aware that your feet had blisters, that your throat was stripped by too much upchucking, and that you felt alone in your head. You were embarrassed by your distraction. The physical body had never occurred to you so much in previous meditation. The light from the ceiling above had dulled to a sooty orange glow, like that from a lit furnace. You fell into a numb, half-alive, half-dead reverie, your anxiety stifled and calcified, until you heard Ianthe cry out. You stared through the minute slit where your hood brushed your cheeks. You made no sound, because you were not sure you were seeing what Ianthe was seeing. For your part, you saw the water.
Chapter 7. The water came bubbling up through the bolted seams in the floor panels, a filthy, rusty red, with a bloom like sewage upon it. It had already boiled up to the front of the shuttle, and was to the top of what you could see of the Emperor's shoes. It seemed unsure of gravity, running this way and that. Then it started coming in high-pressure spurts through the sides of the cockpit's front window.
30 seconds, said Mercy Morn, whose voice had gone so utterly from petulant to clinical that it seemed the voice of a different woman. 5 minutes 30 remaining. There was rustling from right next to you. The Emperor said,
"Keep flat."
Ianthe said urgently, "Lord, I can see them."
"Them?"
But the Emperor said,
"Focus on them. Don't be afraid. Take off your hood if you want to. But think about the details of the shuttle, too. Where you were, where I am, where Mercy is, where Harrowhark is. The details of the shuttle are a projected memory, and they are not all real. But they will dissolve further as you leave your body behind, and I don't want to lose you."
"To the empty reaches of space? Or to Mercy?" The Lictor said,
4 minutes 30 seconds remaining. Ward has an estimated 30 seconds left."
You were too curious to resist. You wrenched the opaline hood from your face and were startled all the way to your soul. Turbid, filmy water was filling up the shuttle at a rate of knots. The floor had gone entirely, and you were affrighted by its wet and corporeal reality. You were soaked through almost to the ribs by tepid, greasy waves. Ianthe had sat up. She never could follow instructions, but she was staring glassy-eyed at some point you could not see, rigid and uncomprehending. You scanned around, but the body was nowhere to be seen. It was just water. It soaked the hems of the Emperor's trousers. He sat calmly, flicking at his tablet, as though it were no inconvenience. You could not quite see the other Lictor,
except her arms, bathed in the glow of the cockpit switches. The water seeped around your neck and started trickling into your ear canals. This did not fill you with the rigid terror it apparently produced in Ianthe. As a child, you had been plunged into water by your mother and father, so the sensation was old and familiar, if wretched. The waters swirled and rose. They brushed against your cheeks, and you reflexively held your breath.
"Let that go, Harrow," said God, tapping on the tablet with his stylus. "You don't need to breathe."
You exhaled, trickling it out of your nose and mouth. Your brain panicked briefly as you took a shy lungful of warm, muddy water. The fluid went down your throat in a peculiar and unreal way. It sat there, seething in your craw, peristalsis not coming into play. You filled up with water like a rubber doll dropped into a well. It was with very little joy that you saw this was distressing Ianthe a great deal more than it was you. She had wrapped one arm around herself, leaving the rightmost to trail abandoned in the water, and was shaking in a kind of convulsive spasm of the soul. It was only the memory of the knife and the palm that prevented you from being moved to pity. God was saying quite encouragingly,
"You're fine, Harrowhark. You're doing very well."
Which put you in a paranoid panic that you were not, in fact, doing well at all. Something brushed past your ankle, and the water closed over your head. You did not float. You stayed stuck to the bottom like a concrete weight, without buoyancy. Something floated in the water quite close to the pilot's seat where Mercy Morn sat. A long skein of abandoned skin, fresh and virgin, as though taken from someone's flank and carded of its flesh and fat. The water in which it floated felt warm against your eyeballs and smarted a little going up your nose. From the shifting, refracting ripples within this tide, you beheld the wood upon the wall. It was steaming. Its bottom whorls sizzled and sparked like malfunctioning machinery where they touched the water. Showers of blue sparks pattered into the greasy water like rain.
"The ward has lasted for 1 minute 40 seconds, said Mercy Morn. 1 minute 41.
God said,
"Two commendations for the lieutenant."
She called out, 1 minute 44. 1 minute 45.
And in the space between 44 and 45, the ward exploded. The dried blood came off the wall in flakes of brown confetti. It left behind a burnt, warped indentation as it slithered away to dissolve in the rising current. Next to you, Ianthe arched her spine so acutely that she folded up in the middle, as though she had been electrocuted. The light from the panels limned her in amber. Her hood had come loose, and her long, pale hair floated about her shoulders like a caul. You propped yourself up on your elbows, distracted by something nudging against the plex viewing panel where Mercy sat piloting the shuttle. The star-pocked blackness of space had retreated entirely. The shuttle looked as though it were sinking down into a murky, obscure ocean. Another nudge. Then something slapped two wet and rotting hands on the plex.
"Ich! Bluff!" said Mercy Morn, quite calmly. 3 minutes remaining."
"I hate this part," said God.
A nude, fish-eaten body thudded down hard atop the plex, leaving a momentary bloom of blood before it bounced off again. Another hit a few seconds later, but this one stayed put. It was a torso, with the legs gone and the face eaten away, leaving the shiny skull to bang against the surface. It pressed one hand down, as though beseeching, but was sucked away again into the deep water outside the shuttle. The water inside now sloshed up to the Emperor's shoulders, washing over Mercy Morn's hands. She did not bother to take her fingers away from the controls. Ianthe's face remained slack and unfocused. You rounded your spine up cautiously and looked around the shuttle, underwater at the dissipating blooms of brown and red in the liquid, as though someone were bleeding out into it. At the back of the shuttle, You thought... You thought you could perceive a high and keening wail at the very edge of your hearing, but neither God nor the Elder Lictor, and certainly not Ianthe, reacted to it. The wail was coming from within the shuttle. It had a hard, pained edge to it, like frustration. You cast around, trying to figure out from where. There was another big wet thump as a fourth body slammed itself on the plex, and this one managed to hold on, scrabbling gruesomely. But you focused on the thin cry of violence. You found yourself saying, "Someone's crying, Lord." But he just made a nonsense sound beneath his breath, a mumbled word that you didn't recognize.
2 minutes, 30 seconds remaining, said Mercy Morn, and her voice took on a hard edge of caution.
The Emperor said,
"They're not as numerous as I'd have expected."
"I do not like this," said his lictor.
Your eyes slid back up to the ceiling. The water, oleaginous and warming, was thick now with the flotsam and jetsam of bits of corpse. When something bumped your foot, you flinched and grasped a fine fleck of bone from your tibia, tried to work it through your skin to ice over your feet. It didn't precisely succeed. Instead of a fine outer needle of matter, you pulled a wet plug from just above the epiphyseal line, and your shinbone opened like a flower. Your blood and cellular matter opened up on your rainbow robe and floated upward, and God turned around, and his face was indistinct in the murk, but his voice was not,
"Oh!"
He used a word you did not understand.
"Harrowhark, no theorems!"
"Don't be ridiculous. She can't be using theorems," said Mercy. "She'd be barely awake, and it's totally beyond her at this point. John, stop her! She's using theorems!"
The pain did not matter. The shuttle had shivered somehow around you. Synaptogenesis had erupted in your brain case, and your eyes were opening. You were lying in a sea of bodies. They had bumped up against you before you had realized it, before you could flinch away from their nearness. Perhaps the blood conjured them into being, so suddenly were they there. You stood up without thinking, and more bumped gently into your elbows, your arms. They carpeted the bottom of the shuttle. They bobbed in an unseen current low to the ground, lacking the air to drift to the top. Through a thin curtain of your blood, you could see the dizzying array of slippery corpses, their faces painted in black and alabaster greys. Dead girls in their teens, their half-exposed bones still caught in the act of fusing at the caps. Dead boys still shedding their milk teeth. Ungendered infants, mostly skull, their nails like tiny chips of stone. A rubber-bodied toddler with a painted face and very red hair lay dead beside your knee. And for some reason, it was this that destroyed you. It was this that kindled within you something you had no hope of defending against. You howled in a purity of fright. The Emperor was wading toward you through this bobbing array of dead. He was saying something you paid no particular attention to.
"Harrow, it's not real. Only you can see what you're seeing, and everything inside the shuttle is illusion. It's the river. The river is a predator. The dead are in your brain. It's trying harder with you because you're fundamentally deeper in it than Ianthe. I didn't think you'd be able to go this deep first time in, but you have. Walk back toward me."
2 minutes remaining, said Mercy, and "They are coming for the source of the noise. I stood on the bank and watched Cassiopeia die. Teacher."
"Do not rev that engine, Mercy Morn."
"She led them away from the brain. I was there in projection, and I saw when they seized her legs and arms. I was laying stakes for the beast, and I was there. And I thought to myself, Lord, but what will we do with your ceramics collection? There is so much of it."
You pressed your hands to your face and were startled all over again that you could not close your eyes. When you pressed the lids down, the light changed, and you recalled this as though you had done it before. You lost visual complexity. The shuttle was gone, but the water was not, and the bodies were everywhere. You were lost in a deep aperture. Hot, bloody blisters bubbled up from your skin, and you were aware of yourself, not as a structure, but as a sickly radiance. One sickly radiance among other sickly radiances. One, two, three, four, five, all around you, one beneath. The distant scream coalesced. You realized it was coming from you. Your eyes opened. You looked at the blanketing bodies of the dead children of the ninth house, were aware of yourself as an overcluster of 200 pinpricks of light. You were a sigil. You were an intermingled fire. The fluid was sucked from your sinus cavities, and with it your brain, soon disassembled. You were made small. You were a throat. You were an oven. The water was boiling hot and your skin was sloughing off you in reddened, shrinking frills. Those pinpricks boiled within you, and the bodies boiled without. You were a hunger without a stomach. You felt the thanagetic pit inside the coffin, the curve of a childlike jaw, the pallid bow of a dead mouth. You did not understand yourself as standing, nor understood yourself as walking, but you were doing both. You were dying in that hot water. Whatever wanted your meat suit could have it.
"Harrowhark," said God. "Over here. Over here, kid. I daren't touch you. Come toward me. Toward me. Mercy, as you love me, do not push that button."
30 seconds, said Mercy Morn, and quietly. "Lord, you doom your houses."
You could see everything. The shuttle was a tawdry nest of fuselage and metal sheeting, wiped over with plex and anti-friction gels, breakable, startlingly so. You could see in a multiplicity of directions. You could see the dead blood ward churning beneath the water, the metal where it had etched itself curling and seizing beneath superheated steam. You could see your live blood rising up in bright red plumes before you, leaving streaks of red on your robe. Mercy said,
25. The shuttle is becoming porous. I'm starting to feel drag.
Hold it!
Something hit the shuttle like a closed fist. It spun from side to side, going nearly all the way around like a top, and you fell off and away from that needle. You fell to your knees on a soft, dead pile of children, and stared over your shoulder where Ianthe lay propped up on the floor, shrieking shamelessly in fright. Mercy did not pay attention.
20 seconds.
I'll grab Harrow. Gun it!
Oh, thank God, finally. What do you mean, grab?
I'm going to have to touch her. Hit the acceleration.
Wait, Lord, if she pulls you away...
The throttle, Mercy, in Christabel's name! God roared.
She slammed a lever. 5 points of light. Ianthe was staring and insubstantial, shuddering out of her lineation as though vibrating straight out of reality. Everything was borne away into this mad and boiling riptide, and when you followed Ianthe's line of sight, the plex screen of the shuttle was a mass of dead hands and trailing guts and water and blood. From your kneeling point, someone grabbed you from beneath your armpits and dragged you backward. There was a huge and overwhelming sound like some vast machine backfiring, and you kept thinking,
5.
But then there was nothing left of you. Chapter 8. The tea was overwhelming and tasted too much. By choice, Harrowhark had only ever drunk water. When she had been younger or ill, the marshal had made her sugar water with a drop of preserved lemon in it as a treat. Even then, she'd had to take her time over each sip. Each bright citric burst had been half pleasure, half pain on her tongue, the sweetness so acute as to almost hurt her teeth. This new hot stuff tasted like a forest fire. It was with seriously burnt taste buds and no saliva in her mouth that she froze when the dire little man said, smiling,
and perhaps the locked tomb will favour us with their intercession.
What seemed like a thousand eyes turned upon her. With a great internal fury, Harrowheart blanked. It was her cavalier who opened his mouth in the vast, corpsified atrium of Canaan House and began,
"I pray the tomb is shut forever. I pray the rock is never rolled away."
She did not join him. If one did not begin a prayer in perfect unison, better not to pray belatedly. She listened as Autus said words she suddenly doubted he even believed, full of a very weary resentment at herself and at people everywhere. In that rotting hall, there were people of all different sizes and postures. Apart from the three priests, they were all young, or young enough to eyes accustomed to her grey congregation, and they were dressed in a nightmare spectrum of colours and fripperies and materials. Classic Construct stood by, dressed in white. She hated it when people dressed constructs. It smacked of whimsy, like making one's hammer wear a hat. They had provided escort into the hall, dropping big handfuls of something green and white for people to gingerly crush beneath their feet as they walked under the cracked marble arches of the first house dock. She had realised, with a thrill of frugal, exotic horror, that it was plant matter. Some of those assembled had given fleeting backward-shoulder glances to her, and to Autus, and she was aware that she was not imposing, was acutely aware that she might be mistaken for younger, was aware of the optics of Autus, whose bigness and sadness filled rooms she was already minute within, and their gazes held flickers her eyes were too sore to translate. Fine. That was manageable. That was their mistake to make, whole and entire. O course of the locked tomb, she prayed silently to herself. The cold death to anyone who looks at me in pity, the heat death to anyone who looks at me in amusement, the quick death to anyone who looks at me in fear. As Autus finished, the priests of the first smiled just a little, and only with their mouths. It occurred to Harrow that the first and the ninth were the only two houses that understood how to wait for a thing that would never happen. Her cavalier rounded off the prayer dolefully.
"And so hail to the Lord of the sharpest edge, and the gossamer thinness of his blade, and the cleanness of his cut."
"An ancient epithet," said the ghastly old man that Harrow would come to curse as teacher.
He looked near death with excitement. He looked close to capering, which filled Harrowhark with a dry and powdery despair.
"A classic, unuttered for years, even in this house. How may I bless you for that, Autus the Ninth?"
"Pray only that my bones be one day interred in the Anastasian monument, where even the ghost of the light does not go," said Autus, in front of everybody, like an absolute shit.
Even in the shadow the heat slapped down on him, and beneath his veil some idiot had painted him with the skull of the anchorite dying, that idiot probably being Autus. As he wept from the sunshine, the alabaster wounds of the anchorite turned to big runnels of paint. No first priest's blessing could get him inside the Anastasian, the tomb reserved for warriors. Autus was only likely to die with a heretic's blood still wet on his sword, if he found a very slow heretic.
"That is the only blessing I desire,"
the other priests murmured.
"Incredible," said teacher. "I love it. I bless you that way twice. Now, won't somebody fetch me the box?"
What followed was a long and incomprehensible parade of cavaliers, starting with Martyr the Second. After teacher called out,
"Autus the Ninth,"
Autus went up for his prize and returned to present it to his necromancer, as he ought. He placed within Harrow's gloved hands a ring with a single key laced upon the iron, a singularly dull and uninteresting key with two teeth and a triangle head. It sat very heavy in the black leather of her palm. The little man eased himself down upon his stool, from the sides of which no small amount of stuffing was emerging, like a satin cream-filled roll. He said comfortably,
"Now I will tell you something new, something you are not meant to know, about the first house and about the research facility. The base of Canaan House dates back to before the resurrection. We first built upward to get away from the sea. Then we built outward to strive toward beauty. This was meant to be the palace of the kindly master, where he might work and hold court and live for always, and oversee all the rebuilding that had to be done. For the resurrection did not resurrect every broken thing, you understand, and nor did it create anything new. There was hard work ahead, fixing or designing, and it took a great deal of blood and sweat and bone. Yet those were lovely years, happy ones, and that was the time before lictors."
He took a sip of his tea, sighed briefly in pleasure, and continued.
"They were disciples to begin with, 10 normal human beings of the resurrection, though half were blessed already with necromantic gifts. But necromancy alone does not confer eternal life. Our Lord, the first reborn, kept those 10 devotees young and alive through his sheer might, but it was a shadow of living. They had to stay tucked near the emperor's feet so as not to strain his powers. They desired to spend their lives in service of him, not the other way around. They realized, in the first 100 years, how difficult their situation was, even as necromancy spread through the 9 houses, and even as other disciples joined their number. Some of them took up the sword and became the first cavaliers, in the hope that their strength of arms might prove useful. The adepts honed their master's craft, trying to break the rigours of deep space, and there was so much still to be done, and new necromancers being born and ruins to reclaim. What a time to be alive!"
He sighed again, this time more nostalgically, and then he said,
"Necessarily, a great research had to begin into how best to serve alongside our Lord without needing him to confer immortality. This search for what would become lictorhood. And it took place here."
He pointed downward. Everyone looked at the floor beneath his feet, seeking out the origins of lictorhood in a few square inches of rotting carpet.
"Below our feet, the laboratories, the original body of the building, a place steeped in the death of ages, the quietude of the last sacrifice. That is where lictorhood was begun, and that is where lictorhood was finished. You will see it. You will see where they threw down their tools and left the building like a palimpsest, unknowing, for you. Where they left their blueprints to those who may yet have the strength of body and spirit to walk their path. This place was meant to be a palace, and they have left it as a road in the wilderness."
Someone spoke up, the fifth woman, and she said, fearlessly and amiably, "Then the path to lictorhood is independent research. Gosh! And it isn't even my birthday!" One of the young people sitting close to the fifth made a sound like an exhausted balloon squeal.
"Part of the path is independent research, Lady Abigail," said Teacher, smiling. "The other part, the greater part, is the silence, is the care. You are not alone in the facility. In its heart lies the sleeper, and how long that creature has lain there I do not know. But I do know that they are your greatest threat, for although they lie in sleep, in that sleep they walk.
Here he trailed off. He stared into the middle distance, still grasping his cup of tea, as though seeing visions the assembled scions and cavaliers were not privy to. The pause stumbled execrably, fell down the stairs, and lay in a tangle at the bottom in full view of all listeners, who had to watch it bleed out in embarrassment. One of the grotesquely young pair of the fourth actually tried to fill it in and bleated,
"There's a monster in a research laboratory, and we've got to fight it?"
"No, no," said Teacher impatiently. "Lord over the river, have mercy. The sleeper cannot die. I doubt they can be wounded. They certainly cannot be killed. The greatest advantage we have is that the sleeper sleeps deeply. The second threat to your work is if the sleeper wakes. It has never happened, though I know the sleeper yearns to escape its incognizant state and pick up where they left off, for if they wake, none of us will live. If the sleeper meets you on their unconscious peregrinations, your weapon should be stealth. If through unholy means you wake them, there will be no other weapons left. We are reliant on a communal soundlessness. Travel in groups. Tread softly. Go where I durst not go, because I love my life, and I love noise also."
There was no pause here, just a perfect babble.
"Isn't how it...
how much sound is..."
"Doesn't make any."
"What kinds of cat-handed..."
"I do not know the answers to any of these questions," said Teacher calmly, "only that already you are being too loud."
The babble froze in mid-air on everyone's lips. Harrowhark, who had never spoken, and Autus, who had only sweated, almost audibly, stilled further. In that anechoic atmosphere, one could have heard a hair split from someone's scalp and twiddle down to the floor. One could have heard their own heart beating. Harrow did, loud and wet and hot. That silence was absent of anything except those tiny, helpless noises of living.
"I am making a joke," said the vigorous little priest, whose cheerful admission did not ease the room. "I josh, I kid, I do that. Believe me when I say that you are safe up here. You see, if you are not, then there is nothing to be done, not really. It is only down through the hatch for which you hold the key that you are in peril, and it is a peril you will bring on both yourself and those around you. Keep your swords sharp and your theorems nimble. I can guide you no further. This place has changed beyond my ken, but I wish you luck," he added.
And the priest with the long salt-and-pepper plait said very softly,
"I wish you luck."
And the tiniest and most wizened priest added in a wheeze,
"God grant you luck to carry out your task."
Those gathered were almost too stunned to attend to the constructs who came to get them, eyes that had been bright with excitement or anticipation, or even in some cases a weird, weary comfort, were now troubled. They were greeted by those limber, reactive skeletons that moved in the manner of kindly in-laws, welcoming strangers to a house they knew was unfamiliar to them, but nonetheless wanted to prove comforting. They were led away in twos, barring the third house trio, and Harrowhark waited next to her cavalier, who was apparently trying his damnedest not to breathe, for a skeleton to cross over to them. She realized that Autus was very frightened. This was not unexpected.
"Lady, I cannot do this," he breathed. "I cannot protect you in this way. Monsters are beyond me.
The rock has been rolled, Harrowharp said, and she was relieved by how much she believed it. She was not fearful. She felt dry inside, as though the liquid had all been wrung out. Monsters were never beyond her. There was no abomination she could not give a run for its money in foulness.
You are my cavalier primary. Your job is to stand, to face our foes, and to die when the panniers are empty, but not before.
This did not comfort him, strangely enough.
You need a blade, and someone with the will to wield it, he hissed.
How strange. I have never needed such a person in the past.
I would that you had chosen differently.
Harrowhark was unsettled now, and she had been at peace, so she was cruel.
The choice is beyond me now, Nigenad, unless you can conjure me the spirit of Matthias Nonius, in which case I'll take on his services if he promises to not speechify.
Their own first house skeleton, ridiculously girdled in that pure white, had come over to make them both a very respectful bow. A thrill of suspicion was growing in Harrowhark, regarding the fluidity of its reactions. Its movement was too free, and when she angled her body in its direction, it mirrored her in unconscious response, which was beyond her, and therefore beyond any skeleton raiser of the Nine Houses. But her cavalier primary did not seem to notice. He had fallen into a reverie of his own devising, and when the construct gestured,
who wasted time on Ossian instructions for gesture?
He turned instead to her, his dark eyes earnest, his painted skull deliquescing. He cleared his throat.
No,
said Harrowhark immediately, but it was too late.
Baleful the black blade struck at the shimmering stuff of the spectral beast, biting deep in its false flesh. Shrieking, it flailed with its claws at the pauldrons and cask of the ninth, yet his heart never faltered or failed him. Harrowhark, I don't understand why you chose me.
Harrow said,
there was nobody else.
His mask slipped, and not the mask made of alabaster and black paint. Ortus looked at her with his steady, dark gaze, and his heavy face flickered. She realized, with electrified astonishment, that he was exasperated.
You never did possess an imagination, he said,
and, obviously upset with himself, his mask reappeared as swiftly as if slapped back on with both hands. He did not know that she was far more interested than angry, but he added in a hurry,
"Forgive me, my lady. I am overset and afraid. I do not yet know how to die. The locked tomb is far from here, as are its graces, and so I forget myself."
"You do, I agree," said Harrowhark shortly,
and became exasperated herself, though more with herself than him. Ortus could not be blamed for simply being Ortus.
Forget dying, Nigenad, and let's go. It is obviously my fault if I have failed to impress upon you who I am, necromantically. We serve the great corpse that lies dead and unwaking, and should not let our hearts falter or fail regarding some fiendish somnambulist. In the worst-case scenario, you can simply declaim to it, which ought to cure anyone's insomnia.
You are very humorous, said her cavalier with perfect solemnity. I understand. I will follow, lady, and let duty be my pauldrons and casque, and loyalty my sword.
The skeleton construct gestured to them both as they made the initial step to follow, and Harrow was struck when it opened its yellow molded mouth.
Is this how it happens? It said.
Chapter 9.
You could not say with perfect accuracy that you woke up. Having achieved a grotesque molliance and dripped and resolved into a bad-smelling puddle of yourself, you did piece yourself back together again. Your eyes opened, You were lying flat on your back, and slowly, carefully, with great effort of soul, you congealed. A weird, hard wad was present in your lungs, pairing each breath with a hideous trachea whistle. Otherwise you were fine, though dishevelled. Your robes were askew. Your chest was heavy, but not with water, with the shadow of a memory, or the last remembrance of a dream. For a moment you shivered all over. After your lungs, your eyes were the second thing to connect, and they perceived a room both big and dark, with spatters of quiet yellow light. This light resolved the shadowed angles of a high and vaulted ceiling. You recalled the wetness. You recalled the corpses. But then that recollection slithered away. The only thing you could hold on to was where you had been sat. You would know if all your sensation was removed. You would know if your brain had burnt away. You were the Reverend Daughter, and you had been placed in a pew. A heavy weight pressed on your hips and legs. You strained to see, chin tucked hard against the top of your chest, and beheld with relief your double-handed sword. Your relationship with it was becoming increasingly complex. You hated its presence, but the world without it would be unimaginable. You smelled blood. You smelled something else more distantly. Above the blood hung the crisp, fecal sweetness of a rose. You struggled to sit up. The breath seized in your lungs, and you worried yourself out of a thrusting cough, just as a hand touched your shoulder, lightly, in warning. You nearly flinched off your seat. "Quiet," said Ianthe, beneath her breath. She was sitting next to you, an incandescent pillar of white, staring straight ahead. The look on her face was typical of her, a recollection, an icy, exhausted tedium with top notes of intrigued disgust. You were dazed. You hated her to touch you. You glued the sword to the back of the pew with a push, the bone lifting it and muffling the noise, sticking in hot gobs to the genuine wood as you swung your legs over to press your toes to the floor. And you saw where you were, and you were immediately stricken with horror. You had been laid in a pew, halfway down a small, exquisite chapel. Now that you could look, you recognized the tender and yellow light as that which came from hundreds of candles. They lit an interior of shining charcoal-coloured stone, layered with walls of bone. Bone everywhere. Bone enough for 100 ninth house tomb chapels. The chancel formed of long-carved runnels of bone, fretworked into human lace. The black check tiles polished granite beneath your feet, their white counterparts soft, worn squares of femur, orange in that lenient candlelight. And the seats of wood, wood like you'd first seen in Canaan House. Real, brown, glimmering wood, polished to the particular sheen that neither stone nor bone could take. You stared up at a plex cruciform window. Cold stars outside, gleaming with a weird and unearthly light. You stared up at skulls, an ossuary of skulls, a multitude of skulls, set into the wall, overlapping in empty-eyed rows, set cheek by jowl to await infinity. Thin sheets of metal had been worked over this lovely mass of faceless dead in shadowed tints. Deep red crimsons, smoky amethysts, lightless navy. House colours. House heroes brought here to rest. Slender columns of white tapers bathed those bones in forgiving lights that made them beautiful in the way only bones could be for you. The candles were wrapped in different colours, which made them look like the dressed-up throats of flowers, or rings on long, slender fingers. And great clusters of these candles shone down on a central altar, and on the central altar was a body. You were at a funeral. You knew its bride. You'd killed her. you sat in a pew in the chapel, where had been laid the time-apprehended body of Kithareya the First. In order to survive the ghostery of your presence, you sent your brain voyaging elsewhere. You tucked your hands deep inside the veil of your nacreous sleeves and slumped so that the snowy rainbow gauze hid your face. Even the vague pressure of the blade at your back caused the gorge to rise up in your chest and your heart to hammer wildly, as though trying to construct a barricade. But at least the threat of coyly spewing kept you present and sane. You weren't that far gone. It was only the fourth funeral you had ever been to where you had been responsible for the corpse. The corpse on the altar was covered in little blush rosebuds scattered thickly over her, a roseate white like seconds-old bone. They lay in sheaves in her arms. They were tucked in her pallid brown curls and pressed to her feet. On her sweet, dead mouth there hovered a rueful frown. Once upon a time, you might have fallen to position on the kneeler, soft and supple human leather, buttery, lovely, and thanked the tomb that you had lived to see the death of a lictor, enshrined so in such a place.